Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
Yes, sir. I got Sean Porter here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming in. You are a Vietnamese American comedian, and I've seen you many times. Saw you a few years ago for the first time, and that was at the Embarrassed by Night comedy show in Orange County in Huntington Beach. And you're quick, you're fast. In order to be that quick, that fast, you got to be smart. In order to be a comedian, I've always thought you got to be smart. You know what I mean? That goes with the territory. You just got to be smart. Now, I'm not saying
smart on stage, at least. I know a lot of comedians.
Street smart.
Dumbasses off the stage. and I'm not one to also, you know, I'm all through that. But yes, I know what you mean. But,
you got to be quick.
Yeah.
Your mother, I believe, is Vietnamese and your father's black, right?
Yes.
How did they meet?
Like a lot of us Blasians, we're a product of American imperialism, you know.
Tell me about that.
War, you know what I'm saying? That's how they met in Vietnam, obviously. My dad is originally from Detroit, and he volunteered at 17. He was like, I'm going to go fight halfway around the world because that is safer than Detroit at that time. Detroit was so bad. He was like, yo, I'll take my chances. Like, at least in Vietnam, they actually give you a gun to defend yourself. Like, I'm out here.
That is crazy.
Yeah, so he left at a very early age and then became a warrant officer in the Army, a helicopter pilot. And then he met my mom there. Then I have three older siblings. All three of my sisters were born in Vietnam. And then he moved to L.A. and then they had me, like, later.
Are your three older sisters, are they Vietnamese? Are they, like, they act Vietnamese?
Well, you know, it's funny, man. It's like when you're having, like, interracial kids and shit, it's a real crapshoot. It's like what spits out. You know what I'm saying? So my oldest sister, I'll say me and my oldest sister probably look the most Vietnamese. Me and my oldest sister. And then my two middle sisters probably look more, like, on the blacker side. My sister, closest to me, she's like a fucking chameleon. Like, she has a lot of, like, Vietnamese Asian friends. She goes Hawaii a lot. She looks like a Pacific Islander. And she hangs around a lot of black folks. She looks like, you know what I mean? So she's like real chameleon. Like, me, everyone thinks I'm a Pacific Islander. And I go to Hawaii a lot. So,
yeah, you just blend.
I just blend. Anyway. I do this a lot now. You know what I'm saying?
Because you're always in Hawaii.
Yeah. I go to Hawaii a lot. You know, what they call it? Hapas.
Why do you go to Hawaii a lot?
Cause I like to just fuck off and not be cold during the winter, like Christmas holidays. I'll fuck off and go there and kind of recharge the batteries. You know what I mean? That's the only time I get. I tell people all the time, dude, I'm living this comedy life, so it's like no sleep. It's like the only times I get good sleep, bro, is on vacation and planes.
Wait, why don't you get good sleep?
It's shit sleep when you comic.
Because you're always moving around and you're always partying.
Because I'm coming home at 1-2 a.m. Then, you know, you don't eat until fucking 1-2 a.m. You know, it's horrible diet, and then you're up the next day. I'm usually up, like, actually working out or boxing or whatever. So I only get good sleep on vacations and planes, bro.
Yeah.
That's it.
Let's go back to your mom and dad.
If you don't mind,
I'm curious about this. I do talk to kids of interracial couples, but I want to, like, really get to know what it was like for them, if they ever shared it with you, living, because they lived in Vietnam for a few years before they got here.
Bro, my dad didn't want to fucking leave. They were the last ones out. Apparently, the story is that, those big cargo planes, the C-130s.
Cargo plane.
Yeah, they're on, like, one of the second to last planes out as, like, they stormed the embassy and all that shit. Apparently, the story is the C-130 that flew after them got shot down. Like, crazy shit, bro. So, like, yeah, no, my dad was loving life out there, even though, you know, it was in the middle of this huge conflict.
And how long was he living in Vietnam for?
Bro, I mean, they left it. Well, I want to say 75. I think he was got there in mid-60s, I want to say.
Oh, my God.
So, he was there for that long time. Yeah, bro.
Wait, mid to, it's oh, like the beginning 10 years.
Of, like, basically, like, from, the, like, the beginning of the conflict.
So, what, he just stayed there? Like, when? Just re-upped every time they're like, we're going
to,
like...
Oh, dude, he was... Yeah, he wasn't trying to go back to Detroit, man, at that point, okay, dude, you're saying, you see that movie, that Spike Lee movie a few years ago, The Five Bloods? The Five Bloods?
Yeah.
That was basically my dad's wish, at least the first two acts. The third act is crazy. It's an insane movie. But that first act... You know, the friends getting back together in Vietnam, and that like was like my dad's dream is to, you know, he's unfortunately sick now, he's battling cancer, but he can't travel over there. That was one of his dreams, is to go back.
Oh, wow.
Because it was such a thing.
So he watched Star of
Five Bloods, and
he really enjoyed it.
Yeah. That's what he wanted to do, you know.
He stayed there for, I don't know, good 8 years.
Yeah.
And he was always on, like, the wing, like, as a, he looked like a helicopter pilot.
A warrant officer,
So he never really, like, was, like, on the battlefield with the gun. He was, like, more on the wing side itself.
Oh, no. He saw plenty of action.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I know you see plenty of action, but I think there's a difference, because if you're on the ground, you die. Well, the chance of you dying is as a grunt.
Yeah.
But if you're on the wing side and you're always, like, in that capacity, you're flying, you're in the support. Chances of you dying is less, so then, like, that time of being there for 8 years makes sense, right? Yeah. Or did he...
Well,
that's what you say. Was he on the ground the whole time?
That's what you say that, though, because actually, his helicopter got shot down. He almost didn't make it. I tell this wild story. Like, when I do longer sets, like 45, 30-minute sets or whatever, I'll tell these chunk stories now, incorporating my pops a lot, just the arm shit. And one of the stories I tell is about how his helicopter got shot down. And, you know, it was a teenager who shot him down. Like, that's the story. He's, you know, he's flying into this Hot LZ, tall grass. And as the soldiers are, you know, loading up this helicopter, he sees this kid off to the grass, pulls out his pistol. And in that split second, makes a decision, is this person a threat or not? He sees that's a young kid. So he holsters his pistol. Soldiers get on, and then as they're banking, like, I'm sitting down, I don't want to be off screen, but as they're banking, he sees kid go like this, lean down, and fucking RPG, right? Launches it, hits the helicopter. There was 9 soldiers. 1 survived. Barely. My dad barely
survived. That was your dad who survived. So everybody else died.
Yeah. And he had to resuscitate him twice. As they say, like, his eye was out of his socket. It was bad. And so that's how lucky, I know we're all lucky to be here, but that's how extremely lucky I am to be here, right? Like, in the multiverse, 9 times out of 10, in another dimension, he's dead, right? So it's like, wow, dude, that's wild shit.
That's some insane shit.
Yeah. And then I have a crazy ass punchline at the end of that story, but that's what was the passed down to my uncles, and that's the story with my dad. He doesn't really talk about it much. He had that whole PTSD situation, like, he still can't sleep with the lights off. Shit, it's crazy.
And how long was he in Vietnam until he met your mom? And then how many years did they?
You know, I don't know the timeline. I know they were married for about 20 years before they separated. And by the time I came around, they were already on the outs. They divorced when I was young, but had all 3 of my sisters there, and they were. I want to say it's like 20 plus years. Yeah. So. I believe the story I was told is my mom's working, helping my aunt at her restaurant, and I was just helping. And then my dad was just like, would go in there constantly to ask my mom out on a date. You know what I mean? That's a lot of GIs recruited over in Saigon. So yeah, that's where they met. Yeah. My aunt's restaurant my mom's aunt's restaurant.
And then how old were your sisters when they left? I mean, do they remember Vietnam?
Yeah. They all spoke when they were little kids. Wow. They're all very, they're young. I want probably like 8, 6, 4, probably around there.
Something like that. So they're older than I am.
Probably.
Cause you guys left in 75.
They left in
75. And they were like 8 or 6, you said?
I want to say that, yeah.
Oh, shit. They're
lost. Yeah, so they had me. I mean, they had, but they, yeah, they had me like years later.
Years later, yeah.
Like, wait, I was definitely an accident or something.
Oh. Yeah. Wow, man. And is your oldest sister like very Vietnamese?
I think her and I have like almost like the same.
No,
like,
I mean, does she act like mentally very Vietnamese?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, she was always the oldest one's always more most responsible and very, you know what I mean? The oldest ones are usually they're responsible, like the brunt of the parenting, and then it gets loosened to every, kid. So yeah, she's definitely more responsible.
It's crazy because when
she's a good kid, they're all my sisters are all the college.
I ask this because I get have a morbid fascination.
Yeah. I'm definitely the only jackass telling dick jokes on stage. That, you know what I mean? They were definitely.
Yeah, I can't imagine you having a conservative family.
And I was definitely the one that, you know, the youngest one usually is the one that goes this way. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. And then when you guys, when they got to the United States, they just stayed in LA?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my pop followed his brother out here, who was already his older brother, who was already out here. And then, they sent up. And then, he became a police officer.
Your dad did?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. And then what neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up in, like East Hollywood area, almost like between, like, Echo Park, Silver Lake, like, in that area. And then the valley. So, like, part of it, like, from there and then the valley, I was split time to my mom and my dad.
Ah, you moved very far from home.
Very far from home, exactly. I tell people... East Hollywood area back growing up was not the same as these Meat Time hipsters are now. There's no Erewhon and fucking Whole Foods and shit.
It was seriously the hood.
There was a lot of gangs, Hispanic gangs,
big time.
I tell people it was Hispanic gangs and it was gays who couldn't afford West Hollywood. That was Silver Lake.
I never thought of it that way.
Yeah. That was Silver Lake.
Silver Lake.
Yeah, that was growing up. And it was a redlined community.
The poor gays.
Yeah, the gays who could not afford West Hollywood. It was all East Hollywood, and it was like in 18th Street, and like...
Yeah.
Yeah, it was rough.
The rich gays are bordering Beverly Hills.
You're right, yeah. We owe Beverly Hills.
We owe Beverly Hills. That's like where they are. And then the poor gays are... Well, now Silver Lake is probably just as expensive as we owe.
Bro.
If not more. If not more.
As soon as you see
around the reservoir.
As soon as you see the Erewhon pop up, it's like, oh, you're done.
You're done.
I go to my local watering hole, right? I go to my bar, right? This is right up the street from my crib. And I see all these young 20-somethings. And I just in my neighborhood, right? Just walking around and shit. I'm like, there is no way you working as a fucking barista could afford your Silver Lake rent. You're like, your parents is paying for this rent. Your parents is footing your bill so you can, live your dream with whatever it is. You know what I mean?
It's crazy. Yeah, it's a crazy neighborhood. How did you get into comedy?
On a dare. That's how... Oh, shoot. By the way, Mokhai Bai Yo.
Mokhai Bai Yo. Cheers.
I got all the homies doing this, by the way. Where am I looking?
Over here.
I got all my homies doing it. All my round eye friends. Cheers in the Vietnamese now, you guys. I'm trying to hold it down for us. I was already working in entertainment, just behind the camera. Right out of college, I started working as an assistant.
Oh shit!
Oh. Yeah. What about that?
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
You earned a degree in the behavioral health field because you wanted to make a difference. And you're needed now more than ever. Through the new Great Minds Fellowship Program, recent Ohio graduates may be able to receive as much as $20,000 in student loan support when working full-time at a community behavioral health center. Apply before November 15th. To learn more about program eligibility, visit highered.ohio.gov. That's highered.ohio.gov.
I started working as an assistant
in
entertainment.
Production company or agency?
Yeah. Production company, worked my way up. Then I was basically a branding producer for a few shows. And then I just got sick and tired of reality TV that I was working in. It was fine. It was a good gig, but it was something that I did not want to pursue. And I would write here and there. I had comedy friends. We're in the industry, and comedy homies are like, you know what, you gotta take this shit on stage. Yeah, because I played sports growing up too, so I've always been a good shit talker.
Yeah,
I tell people all the time, like I've always
natural
been
shit talker.
I've been a natural shit talker. I just formed it into bits is what I did.
Yeah,
in comedy. But my boys kept like egging me on, and then one of my closest friends, Jimmy Fox, he's in production. He runs a production company. Back then, he was like, dude, I dare you to do open mic. I dare you to do 5 minutes. I dare you to do it. And I went and I did my first open mic at the HaHa in North Hollywood. And then I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Wait, did you know what to expect for the 5 minutes? Or did you just go up cold?
Yeah.
I mean, did you prepare a bit? I mean...
I just talked about myself. I like self-deprecating humor. You know, I've always been a fan of comedy. That's the thing. Been a fan of comedy.
Yeah,
I grew up listening to Richard Pryor, Red Fox albums, and George Carlin and Conan O'Brien. I used to watch Conan O'Brien all the time. He was like, I guess, my generation's Letterman. And so I've always liked self-deprecating humor. And then I just. Did that and really just talked about myself. That was it, and that's where it kind of started. As I tell younger comics, write what you know, as they say.
How many years ago was that?
I want to say 2016 or 2017.
Oh shit, it's just like recently.
Yeah, I'm still a baby in this game.
Yeah, bro. You are. 7 years?
Yeah.
8 years?
Like doing it full time. Yeah, and like... Yeah. Because I'm in rooms with comics who like been doing it for 15 plus years. They call me a baby. They call me
7, 8 years. So a baby.
It's crazy when you think about it, right?
Yeah.
Any game though, you do at 7, 8 years is still a baby.
Still a baby.
But hey, but you know what though? But the audacity of some of these comics. I have comics 2, 3 years in talking about, hey, watch my special on YouTube. I'm like, yo. A special already, bro? You got 2 years, 3 years in?
Why do you say that? Why do you react like that?
Because I think that...
I mean, if you're good in 2, 3 years, why not do a special? Why not break the
ceiling? That is true, right? But the key word is good. And I know all art is subjective, but I equate it... Again, I'm an athlete, so I use a lot of sports analogies here because I grew up playing football and martial arts and boxing and all of that. I box over at Freddie Roach's gym, over Wild Card, where Manny Pacquiao trains. And I remember him telling me, you know, it takes about 7 years to produce a 10-round fighter. It takes 7 years of training to produce a 10-round fighter. And I equate the same thing with comedy, man. It takes...
10 years.
10 years. It takes 7 years, 8 years to produce 45 or 60 minutes of quality material. That's just me. To actually mean honing your craft... Being a professional comedian, just like a professional boxer, requires your mental and your physical stamina to know what going on the road is like, to know what developing bits are like, to know to develop all the tools in your belt. Because a lot of comics, if you're in year 2 or 3, you haven't worked every room, right? I tell you all the time, it's like you're like a wedding DJ. You got to know what, you got to play to your room. Okay, I got this crowd tonight. I got this in my tool belt. I got that crowd tomorrow. I got this in my toolbox. I guarantee you a comic who's 2, 3 years in have not worked. I'm sure they've worked white rooms, but they haven't worked the black room yet. They haven't worked the Hispanic room yet. They haven't worked an Asian room yet. They haven't worked an all-gay show yet. They haven't done... You don't have enough of that. You know what I mean? You haven't worked in Washington State at this podunk town in an all-white room, and then you haven't worked over then in New York or Brooklyn or something like that, or Texas or San Antonio, you don't have that life experience. But with social media, and there's good, real good things with social media, but one of the downsides is that, you know, if you have enough followers and enough traction there, then you feel like you then have the world experience to then go and shoot your special.
But that's a huge delusion.
As I tell people, TikTok and then performing stand-up, there's two different sports. It's two different sports. You know what I mean? It's two different sports.
Yeah, they're very different.
Yeah.
They're very different. Because one, I think the stand-up, you're feeding off live audiences. And then the other one, when you're just shooting some for TikTok or social, there's really no feedback. There's no real live biofeedback that you're like
working. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. When you're in that room, you're in a living, breathing
room.
Yeah. And you have to be present. And in that moment, have to decipher, all right, this eating dick. Oh, should I pivot this way? Should I go this way?
Oh, I saw you do it the other night.
Feed? Yeah, you saw me do it the other night.
I saw you pivot.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, shit, I'm watching. Okay. I'm watching this live. Yeah, that was crazy.
Yeah. And that's the fun part. I love that shit.
Oh, shit.
That's what I love about it. I love that I'm up there by myself on this tightrope. You know, listen, nothing against improv people, improv troops, and all that. But I'm like, listen, I'm not. They're all, oh, we're going to bomb together. Oh, you know, it's like, fuck that. No, I don't, you know, 10 people on the stage. No, stand up there on your own, butt naked, butt ass naked. And expose yourself.
Yeah, that's what you're doing.
I love
it. But the week before that on the same stage, you're fine.
Oh,
perfect. It was like,
yeah.
I was like, oh, this is crazy.
Yeah.
It's completely different.
Completely different energy. You know, and it had a lot to do with, you know, not to get into details, but, you know, before the show and the problems production-wise that we're facing and all of that. And then this crowd's here to see
a different thing
as opposed to, you know, a bunch of, you know, laughs and yuck, you know, as opposed to last week. They know this was a comedy show. So, you know, different, various, but that's all part of the journey. You're going to get all of that. You know what I mean?
When did you start to notice that there's differences in these rooms, and then be okay with it? Because you were okay with it.
Oh,
I saw it. Yeah. But when does that kick in? Because is it that on the third year, second year, right away? Like, when do you start to kind of, like, be mature about this? Like, wait a minute. There's a fucking different type of audience everywhere I go.
Right.
I just got to adapt and overcome.
Yeah, that's a good question. I would probably say year two or three, you just stop. You know, one of the things that like Dana Carvey said, I take to heart, one of his advice is like, you know, try not to try. You know, try not to try when you're up there. Meaning, if you're trying too hard to get, hey, everyone like me, you know, you're gonna look thirsty, right? It looks phony. You know, one of my mentors used to say, you know, have the audience come to you. You don't go to them. Have them come to you with your perspective. And if they like it, great. If they don't, eat a dick. Who cares? But you go on to the next show. You know what I mean? It's not life or death. So I think after like year two or three, when I was like, hey, I'm in it for the craft and the journey and the experience of it. And okay, if I had an off night, who gives a shit? I get to go up tomorrow. That's another thing I tell these young comics too. I don't know why comics come to me for advice and shit, but I don't know. But anyway. I tell these young comics, like, listen, man, this is baseball. It's 162 games. It's a fucking marathon. No one show is going to make or break you, right? So, like, one night you might go 0-4.
Yeah.
The next night you might go 1-4. And then the night after that, boom, you're going to hit for the cycle.
Nobody's batting 500s, man.
But you're going to go. Yeah. But the thing is, though, you get to live to fight another day.
Yeah.
Meaning I get to go at bat tomorrow.
Yeah.
Right? And, like, make up for whatever that was. It's baseball. It's 162 games. You're not going to bat 1,000. You hit the ball 3 out of 10 times over your career, you're in the Hall of Fame. You're batting 300. That's a Hall of Fame hitter.
300 is like huge.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? So just, you know, believe in your craft. And when you have a voice that's authentic, people will gravitate to that. Even if they didn't think you're funny or not, they're saying, oh, this person is authentic.
Yeah. How funny do you think you really have to be? And here's my question. Does a comic really need to be funny, or does he need to connect in an authentic way and then thereby making people laugh at and be tickled at the material, right? Because when I think of Chappelle, right?
Yeah.
I think Chappelle is not funny because it's like laugh out loud, fucking like dying funny. That's not what Chappelle is about. His shit is, he's pointing out something so authentic and universal that it tickles you and then you're laughing about it because it's like, whoa, that's the funny shit that he thought of. But it's not like laugh out loud, like I'm rolling on the floor. But I love to watch Chappelle for that.
Inner reading, right?
But where do you, philosophically, where do you stand on all that?
I go by the Jerry Seinfeld theory, which also my birthday twin, April 29th, Jerry Seinfeld and I. He says it's three parts your material, one part your material, one part your stage presence, and then one part how you are, your mannerisms, gestures, how you're saying this material. And he uses like a Bernie Mac as a perfect example of someone who's just on that stage, just the presence that he has. And the joke might not even be the smartest, wittiest joke, whatever, but how he's delivering it with his mannerisms and all that, how he's, it's amazing. So I think it's that those three parts. That's what I go by. You know,
yeah.
It's your stage presence. It's all it's material stage presence, and then it's also your mannerisms and how you do things. Like I don't do impressions. I don't do a lot of act outs. I'm not a very physical comedian. Yeah. I'm more, I have to write my ass off, you know. But
oh no shit.
But also like, you know, how I deliver certain things. It's you know, I also play piano as well. So I do like the crescendo and variations of emotion, and so I'll start here, and then if I get somewhere, I'm passionate about something, I'll get louder, I'll pick it up, or you'll know how passionate I am about something, or you know, if I'm angry about something, show, you know, like anger is very funny on stage too. Someone who's like talking about something, who's like fucking pissed off about what happened, or something like that, like a Lewis Black or something. The funny is in his anger, right? Like it's you know, or like a Sam Kinison or something like that. So I like to change tempo a lot because now, you know, that keeps the audience, I think, engaged, at least for me, keeps them engaged as opposed to just a very monotone way. You know, and there are comics who are successful that way, but I like to change tempo a lot because you know, it's like why do we have a, you know, a hook in a song? It's because you know, you have to have a key change to keep the, you know, engaged.
That is profound. I never heard anybody make an analogy with the movements in music to comedy. I mean, it would make sense, right? Because I think we're all kind of built the same, right? Our sensibilities and crescendos and how things build up and choruses and they're all sort of like universal.
Right. Right. You know, and you know, there's not one method to it. Everyone has their method. Again, art is very subjective, but there are common themes in either joke structure, presentation that are across the board, regardless if you're a Mitch Hedberg or Carlin, or Mike Epps, or Bernie Mac, there's still a through line with a lot of that, you know? There is science behind joke structure. There is science behind, you know, how you tell a joke.
I'm going to ask a dumb question.
Sure.
You love the world. What makes black comedians so fucking funny? I mean, we got white and Asian comedians funny too, but something about black comedians,
tragic.
My brother and I...
Tragedy.
I wasn't expecting that.
Tragedy plus Patton Oswalt. Tragedy plus time equals comedy. And you know, the two probably funniest groups of folks in Hollywood are
black
Jewish
Jews.
Comics and black comics. And tragedy on both ends. Tragedy produces laughter, man. That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. You've heard me do this bit again about, like, you know, us beats. Our time's coming. Our time's coming. It just takes a while. It just takes a while from that tragedy. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, we've had at least 2-3 generations of not being bombed. Okay, we don't have to think about surviving, where we're going to eat. That's when you can focus on art. You can finally, when you have stability, now you can finally focus on art. and then get that tragedy, pull from that pain to then get that return on investment and then spit it back into something that's fun.
I mean, people don't remember, probably a lot of people don't remember Jamie Foxx as a comedian.
I know.
Right? Mm-hmm. But I remember when I'm looking at him and I close my eyes and I think of him in Living Color and the smirk. And then
he's so talented, multifaceted.
You're like,
so
wait a minute. You go from like, I remember him. Living Colors. He was like the funniest.
Shanae. Right. Doing Depressions.
And it was so funny. And then you're like, wait a minute. And then he goes to music. And then he goes to acting.
Insanely talented.
Yeah.
And I mean, his impressions. I mean, he could just go play piano, sing, everything. I mean, I feel like his star was so bright.
Right, yeah.
It was just like, I can't just be doing stand-up. I'm such a bright star. I gotta, you know what I mean?
So I bring him up, mate, because you sound like you are into a lot of things like piano and sports and MMA and boxing and comedy and all these things that makes us human. When I look at a comic or a film director or a film writer, like, that's like one of the key indicators for me. Mm. If this motherfucking person is going to be quality, like, entertaining me or not, is the amount of, like, consumption that they're doing with life, right?
That's a good point. Yeah, no, I see. You know who's also an example of that today is Donald Glover. Also another example of
Childish
that, right? Childish Gambino, right? But he started, you know, as a writer, as a young guy, you know, in SNL. Started an SNL writer and then did stand-up. And then
rap.
Within 3 years of that, got his first special. So we were talking about earlier is about, you know, sometimes it's not, you know, sometimes if you're that good, right, you'll get there a lot sooner than others. And then he's like, yeah, I'm going to start to do music now. And then fucking Childish Gambino popped off. And he's like, all right, now I'm going to start directing and writing. Fucking Atlanta was won Emmys. So he's like, whatever he wants to do.
He's insanely smart.
Insanely talented. You know what I mean? And that's a good point. I agree with you.
But do you ever look at yourself or people that you're associated with, like people in your circle, and be like, man, we got the Jamie Foxx of the world. We got the Danny Glovers of the world. And then do you ever, because I found myself doing this, comparing I don't even compare opportunity. I just compare balls. Like, do you have the courage to do it, right? Mm-hmm. Then do I have the brain and the talent to do it?
Mm-hmm.
And then do I have, like, the volition, the power in my soul to put it out there?
Yeah.
Like a Danny Glover or Jamie Foxx.
Yeah.
But do you ever look at yourself and go, damn, in order to be that star, to be that burning bright star, you kind of have... It's things that you can't even touch. It's intangibles, right?
It's insane. Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I try not to, you know, as they say, comparison is the thief of joy.
Yeah, yeah.
So I try not to compare myself. I look at, like, a Jamie Foxx and a Donald Glover, like, in awe. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
oh, you can't help it.
Yeah, you can't compare. Right. I'm, like, in awe. I look at it more as, like, man, that is amazing what they've carved out.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to be my authentic self, and from what that happens, whatever happens, happens. But I think the most important thing of all of that is drive. You gotta have drive.
Yeah.
You gotta have ambition. You know, like, anyone who knows me, they'll tell you, like,
driven.
Like, you know, Sean reads the Bible. His Bible is Mamba Mentality. That's my Kobe Bryant's book. That's my Bible. Like, Kobe Bryant's, like, you know, my goat. That's it. His world, his life's his mission,
his
Bible, his ethic, the things that he preaches.
That's what you
is something that I really try to live by.
Which is what? Can you tell us about it for those who don't know what the
Mamba mentality is? All right, for those who don't know the Mamba mentality, if you're Vietnamese and you don't watch basketball, how dare you? Because we all watch basketball, okay? We're fucking Asian. You're either Golden State Warrior fan or Laker fan, okay? Mamba mentality is getting better, becoming obsessive with your craft and your passion, and getting better every single day, and have a relentless drive about you, and every single day mapping out your goals from short term to long term, writing them down, speaking them into the universe, but then actually putting in practical things that you can do to better yourself on a daily. And having that pursuit, that driven passion, and become obsessive with your craft.
And is that what you do with comedy? Are you obsessed?
Absolutely.
With
like,
okay.
Tell me your routines then. And again, everyone's method is different.
Yeah.
You know, but
like, what do you obsess over?
I'm obsessed over
I got to keep going to stand up. I have to keep going to shows.
So like, I'll give you an example. It's a good point. Like I have a theatrical and commercial agent. I'll go on auditions. You know, I'll shoot some commercials here and there, or whatever. But like. And I have friends who are also, you know, actors, well-known, who are all that, who are like, yo, man, you need to do, you know, more commercials and movies and stuff, and you have a good voice and face and all that. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, sure. If that happens, sure, fine.
They come beating near to it,
yeah. Fine. We'll deal with it then. But right now, I am living, breathing, thinking jokes 24/7. I just want to be a good joke writer. That's it. I want to be just one of the funniest dudes in the room. The best compliment I think you can ever give a comic is when a comic, you know, that's a comic's comic. I want to be a pro's pro. That is, I'm obsessed.
Your end goal, yeah.
Living, breathing, thinking, writing jokes constantly, either in my head, on paper, in my notes, on my phone, a premise, a bit, or whatever, you know, I'll wake up every Monday and I'll look at, you know, this past news cycle and I'll write monologue jokes. You know, monologue jokes I think are a great exercise for joke writing because there's a specific structure to it.
You know, I have a question about,
yeah. And I'll just do that and I'll just write monologue jokes just as an exercise.
Yeah.
As a training exercise. You know what I mean? I'll still hit an open mic even though I do tour and all that stuff and I'm, you know, what a professional comic. I'll still, if my friend's doing an open mic,
you roll.
I'll still go do it. I'm not good. I'm not, you know, too good for an open mic.
Yeah.
Because that's a workout. I'll tell other comics.
Yeah.
Let's go get a workout in.
Oh, wow.
That's a workout. You know? Shows around LA I use as a workout. It's hitting the gym.
Yeah. Wow.
You know? So, anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted.
You know,
great scotch, by the way.
I appreciate it.
Awesome. Cheers, man.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate you being here.
Yeah. You know, I normally don't drink, but, you know, Ken's a fish, so, you know, he's a lush, so he wanted us to drink. It's 9 a.m. right now.
Let's fuck around. I know. Be careful when motherfuckers say shit like that, because those are the guys that get you in trouble. Just word of advice to the young.
yeah, exactly.
This is the kind of guy that will get you in trouble. In storytelling, like when you study Joseph Campbell or when you study the hero's journey, and when you study like all these Greek mythologies, there's some odd number out there, like 160 different formations of stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
Different ways you can craft a story to make a movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Boy meets girl, then, you know, girl dies in tragedy. Like there's like 150, maybe 200 of these combinations. Mm-hmm. This is what I've heard over the years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where it's printed or where it's set up, but you can basically look at the chassis or the frame of any story and be like, okay, that belongs in story number 35 or number 29.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, people can do this.
Mm-hmm.
When I listen to comics and I'm like, whoa, that's weird. I remember hearing that same joke, but with a different skin, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's like, in my mind, it's like, oh, that's like, joke number 450 just with a different skin on it.
Mm-hmm.
The potential of you writing and performing jokes that you've heard in your life somewhere else and putting and unknowingly putting a skin on it.
Mm-hmm.
Does that happen? Do you fear that?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that I think that's what I was talking about, like, you know, the through line between comics. There's certain, like, one of my mentors and, you know, person I studied with, his name's Greg Dean. Shout out to Greg Dean.
I've heard of him.
If you're
out of West Side?
Yeah.
I've seen his name on, like,
you're a young comic, they say, you know, comics always have this debate about, you know, should I go to comedy class and all that stuff like that. It's like, listen, no. Like, Greg, you know, I worked with him one-on-one. You gotta be funny, inherently. You can't teach funny. Right, but what Greg does is he
pulls it out.
He's worked with Robin Williams. His name is on the wall at the Comedy Store. I mean, he's been 30, 40 years in this game. And so what he did was saw all these great comics and through line, and then reverse engineered what makes a joke funny and the science of joke structure. Like I was talking about, the science of the joke structure, the through line between, regardless if you're Carlin or Richard Pryor or Mike Epps or Patton Oswalt, there's a structure and there's a science. Yeah, there's combinations of it and there's different spins on it. So, you know, you want to do stuff that works. The things that usually work, you know, you want to talk about dating and romance and being married or being single or, you know, well, you know, a lot of the tropes, right? But the trick is putting your own spin on it, right? Like, everyone loves a dick joke. Everyone. I have dick jokes, but my whole thing is like, okay, how insightful can I make this dick joke? You know, but part of my writing process is, you know, you take the complicated and make it simple, and you take the simple and make it complicated. I start there. So when I do a dick joke, is how smart can I make this dick joke?
Yeah, yeah.
How insightfully dumb can I make this dick joke? Yeah,
makes sense,
right? Like I do this bit. Like, you know, people ask us, like, you know, how I talk about politics and race and all that stuff. Is like, what I like to do is I like to backdoor politics. I like to. So, you know, you think I'm going this way, and then I hit you with this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I like to backdoor it. I won't. You won't see it coming.
Yeah.
You know. So I do this. You know, dick joke about, like, you know, and this did happen. You know, this female is a crowd shouts, so where are you, black or Asian down there? Right. And then you think I'm doing this Asian black stereotypical dick joke, and I hit him with a white privilege thing. I go, oh no, my dick's white. Actually, I'm white down there. Like, why? Like, why? It's like, why are you white now? That's because my penis has a false sense of entitlement. You know what I mean? I don't do that way. Like, you know, and I go that. So it's like, I talk about white privilege, but you think you're getting this dick joke. And I go this way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, make the complicated simple, make the simple complicated. I think that's one of the third-degree black belt of writing.
Yeah.
You know?
I get it. I also love it when comics take something that's very slow and they speed it up. Or something that you think is very fast, and they just slow it. They slow time down by explaining it and breaking it down. And when you see time slow down through words,
it's Chris Rock is brilliant at that. Chappelle is brilliant at that. Again, you take something complicated like race relations, and then simplify it down to a funny analogy or whatever that makes it digestible for everybody.
Yeah.
Right. And then they just hit you with something that's dang smart, makes you think. And was funny as shit, right? Or take something as simple as a fart joke or dick joke and then,
you know, complicate it. Yeah. Make it complicated.
Yeah.
You know, when I think about musicians or singers and they make albums, right? They got 10 songs. They got to remember all these lyrics. And then 2 years later, they follow up with another album. And then 3 years later, they do another one. Mm. So you got, like, you know, through the lifetime of an artist, you got, like, you know, 8 albums, right?
Right.
On average, maybe. In comedy, are you thinking in terms of, like, albums? Mm-hmm. Are you thinking in terms of songs? Are you? Because that's a lot of information to organize. And
right.
So I wonder. And this is the first time I've ever asked him, because, you know, I've had a lot of comedians on the show, but different comedians inspire different things. You definitely inspire a very technical side of comedy for me.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I
when
I ask my agents.
I've had a lot of comedians that you work with. I've had them in here. But you inspire a very technical side of me to come out and ask about that. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, our approach to, you know, again, I just use of music now is because I play piano. I think, you know, being raised on classical music was very regimented, very, very disciplined.
Yeah.
And then, you know, me, you know, being trained as a jazz pianist, which is very improvisation and very there and present and in the moment. And speaking language in real time, doing solos. I think you need both. And so you need the science and the technical part of the joke structure, but then also you need to be present in the room and be able to improvise and be able to play jazz. I think it's great to have both of those tools. So when you're talking about, like, the technical side of it is, like, as an artist,
how can I explain it?
So basically... So as an artist, like, being technical about it, you have to have then, even Robin Williams, even though he was, like, freeform, thought of mind, whatever, still had joke structure, set up, punch, then act out, then tag it with, then improvise something, then be able to do an impression, and then go into another joke, but then I'll set up, punch, right? When you're telling stories, you still have to have punchlines in your story. That's one mistake a lot of young comics make, yeah, is they'll tell a story
and no punchline,
with no jokes in it.
Yeah, because then it doesn't.
Even in your setup, the story, you still gotta have.
I mean, resolution.
We need resolution. Did I answer that question? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And so, like, you still. So that's what I mean by, like, living, breathing, thinking jokes constantly. When I was deep in my piano training, I would be thinking, living, breathing, hearing notes in my head all the time because I was so invested in music, you know?
Yep.
You have to have that level of obsession and appreciation, but also at the same time, I think being a student of the game is very
important.
Very important. You have to be a student of the game. And when you're a student of it and you start studying these things, then you see a through line, like I was saying, and you can have a different spin on it, or a different skin on it, or a different face on it. But there's still this through line of what makes someone get to that point, you know? And being respectful of it and, being a student of it. I think it's very important. Whatever craft that you're in.
You know, I'm about to do something I've never done on this podcast. Mm. And you can say yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
But there's literally a piano behind you. We can move a few things and keep that keep that camera rolling. And I just want to hear a few bars. I just want to hear. But we don't have to do that right now.
Yeah.
You can say yes or no.
No. It's all right. I sight read to stay sharp. I wish I had the time to play the piano as much as I do, you know, as I did, but I've, like, basically replaced it with comedy. So I'm okay. I can play a little something, but it's just, yeah.
Play a little something and,
yeah. But, yeah, no, it's like, you know, I wish I had more time throughout the week to play more. You know, when I used to train with, like, one of my mentors, he passed away not too long ago, and then, like, comedy took over. And so, you know, as I say, there's not enough time in the day.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's a lifelong journey.
Yeah.
I love it. I've been, you know, my agents on my ass, I've been asked that a lot. Like, why don't you incorporate your piano into your, you know, your set?
Routine, yeah.
And I'm like, yes, that lane has already been traveled. It's like, you know, the Craig Robinson of the world and, you know, Zach Galifianakis does it. So Craig many Robinson. Musical, Craig Robinson, amazing.
He's been doing it for years.
Yeah, for years. Yeah, he's been playing every single set you see him around L.A. Is this keyboards there? Yeah, that's what he's known for. Yeah, Zach Galifianakis, brilliant. When he started out, a lot of these young comics don't even know.
I didn't even know.
Look at Zach Galifianakis' old he would play in a baby grand piano. He was a piano comic.
I did not know.
Really good.
Especially Craig Robinson, I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
He's a funny dude.
Yeah, man.
You talk about the actor, right?
Craig Robinson? Yeah, Hot Tub Time Machine, yeah.
Yeah, Hot Tub Time Machine and all the Judd Apatow movies, right? I did not.
He's a funny dude. Dude, you see him on every fucking commercial now from Burger King, all them jingles. That's him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he produced and writes all those jingles. Yeah, get paid. Mm-hmm.
So, when did you start making a living and not having to do regular work? What year was that?
Very recent. Very recent.
And then the next question is, what did you do for work while you were, like, trying to be...
I was in tax resolution. Yeah, I was like, I did the taxes. I did more of the sales side, but I was an enrolled agent and licensed tax practitioner.
Oh, shit.
They made licensed
a lot
tax practitioner.
Of money, man.
I know.
And you gave all that up to do this.
Yeah. Idiot. Yeah. Especially with Asian parents. Yeah.
I mean, you can't do shit on the side, do side hustles. And...
I do. Like, during tax season, I still have, like, a high net worth and clients and shit that I'll still.
I'm not low that worth, but.
No. Oh, no. I got you. Listen, I've helped out so many comics with their tax issues and stuff.
Okay, so that's your bread and butter then.
Yeah. Like, I'll during tax season stuff. I'll still do that.
That's solid as fuck.
Part-time. But made a decision to, you know, there is no plan B. You know, this is what I'm driven to do. This is what I want to do. And try to explain that to your Vietnamese mom.
Would you go to school for accounting? Or, I mean...
No. That's the funny thing about it. I did it. I just landed in that because I needed some part-time stuff as I was transitioning. I was a communications major and then went, and like I said, and I started as an assistant and all that and was working behind the scenes. And then when I finally made the transition, I was like, okay, I'm going to do this.
it's like, okay, I need a gig here that, you know, I don't know how to bartend or wait tables.
Yeah.
Like a lot of my friends. I just needed something that could be flexible and be my own boss. And then I kind of landed in this thing. And then I went and studied and took my tests and all that shit.
Man.
I was doing the math. Made it happen. My tax guy, yeah. I was sitting in his office. We asked him, like, how many things does he prep during tax season?
Yeah.
The number was ungodly, the amount of money that I made. Oh, I was like, wait, they make that? It was crazy numbers for the year. And then it's like, for the rest of the year, you don't have to really do nothing. You don't have to read your life, right?
So then I'll do that and, you know, put some money away.
Wait, yeah.
And then I'll, you know, go hit the road. And,
yeah.
But, very recent, man. And, like, what's happening now, I want to say, at least what changed post-COVID from pre-COVID, is that what you'll get now is a lot of these clubs now, they stopped developing artists and they got very lazy and social media reliant. So now, post COVID, it's more so how many followers does this comic have? Irregardless of the material and whether we believe in this comic or not,
that's a fail safe way for businesses.
If they have
social numbers.
Because we just need to put butts in seats,
buy drinks,
and that's it. And it, regardless of the act, right? It's very lazy. Just like, you know, today in Hollywood with the whole self-taping and shit. I hate that shit. But now, a lot of, you know, casting studios will put everything on the actor now. Like, now I got a fucking light, too. I can do all this shit other than, hey, like, can I just come in the room, talk my shit, and leave? Like, no, because that costs them money. So now let's just put that on the things, right? Post-COVID. And it's like...
But then you can argue for the other side. You have a lot more opportunity now.
You do. And there's a lot there. There's opportunity for more voices. There used to be only three lanes or three gatekeepers. Now you can circumvent that. And voices that probably weren't heard pre-COVID now have a lane.
Yeah,
so you can argue the other side too. That's what I'm saying. There's good and, you know, and there's some bad about social media.
And I'll take it one step further. You still need to do your 10 years. Here's where the proof is.
Malcolm Gladwell, right?
Malcolm Gladwell, since I was hours. But you look at like Stephen Ho, right? Mm-hmm. Look at Linda Dong. Both those cats, 10, 12 years in their gig.
Right.
I look around the environment, the ecosystem that you come from with Fred and Andy, mm-hmm. these guys, 5 years, seven
mm-hmm.
years.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, you got Linda and Steven, you know, they got a good 5 or 6 years on all of you guys.
I mean, before Matt Rife, like, blew up, I mean, yeah, people don't realize he's been a comic for about 8 to 10 years before.
I did not know that.
He was actually a comic. He didn't just pop off, you know, what do they say, you know, overnight sensation. 18 years in the maybe.
Yep.
Right? You still got to put in those hours, you know? And I'm elated. I'm excited to bring it back full circle to our culture. Because I didn't grow up with a Vietnamese culture. The only Vietnamese culture I got was from my mother. I had one aunt out here, but the rest of the family's in Vietnam, right? I grew up culturally black. I grew up on my black side of my family. And so I got very few of that. So I didn't have any Vietnamese friends growing up. I was an athlete, right? None of us. Not too many of us. I didn't grow up in Orange County. You know what I'm saying? And so it wasn't until I started this journey is when I connected. I was like, oh, wait, there's Vietnamese comics out here? And so I became I just gravitated towards it. One, because there was a sense of pride there, but then two, to honor my mother and really jump in culturally to what I missed out on growing up.
Yeah.
You know? And so I take it very seriously, man, like extremely seriously. Like even mixed Asians, like there's, I have this whole hopla text chain. Like it first started with like three of us. And then
that just sounded like you said, I have a hopa sex chain.
That's the next one that's
coming. Hopa sex chain. All
right, tell me about it. There's all this Denny shit going on. No, that's not happening. No, I have this text group. It was just three of us. It's like hopa's in the entertainment industry. And then now it was grown to like 8, 9 of us now. And so, like, you know, we're all like, you know, hoppers and berries together. But it's the same thing, you know, with my Viet comedian friends, you know. And I gravitated towards it. And I take it very seriously, man. Very seriously. Yeah. You show up for us. I show up, man, as much as I can. I try to make up, again, for that lack that I had growing up. And it's a beautiful thing, man. I'm very, 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 very prideful and proud to be a Vietnamese American, you know. Even if I'm, you know, half, you know, just the fact that, you know, I've been accepted.
My kids are half Taiwanese, Vietnamese.
Okay.
But I always tell them, you're not half.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You can't be half.
Mm-hmm.
You're 100% Vietnamese, and you're 100. You come from 100%.
I like that.
Vietnamese, and you come from 100% Taiwanese.
Yeah.
You cannot be half.
Yeah.
You are 100% of each of these cultures.
Yeah.
And genetically, you are 100% of. Yeah. So it's just like, you either are going to go find it and then become it, right? Yeah. But I don't know if you're.
Yeah.
I don't look at any of. Because I have my kids now, I don't look at anybody as half. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you that's either grew up with your black side and you don't know much about your Vietnamese side, but, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I would go, growing up, going to a temple with my mom.
Yeah.
You know, and celebrate Tet and all that. And I, you know, always had that culture. You know, I grew up, you know, my mom was a chef, but at home, we only ate Vietnamese soup.
Right.
But I grew up with that.
So wait, where did she cook at when you were growing up?
Oh, she was a chef at the Westin Bonaventure in downtown.
Wow. All those years.
She started as, she only had one job when she came out here, man. She started in housekeeping.
And worked her way up, bro. At the Westin her whole entire life.
As a housekeeper.
And worked her way up.
That's insane.
One job. When I was a kid, we would go and take family that came in from out of town always to the Westin.
Yeah.
Because it was the highest building.
That was a premier destination. Like presidents would used to stay.
Totally.
She met Reagan. She met Clinton. Like throughout the years, it was a big, you know,
it was a big deal.
Big time. Yeah, it was a big deal.
That a lot of people that come to LA don't realize the Westin was the tallest building.
Yeah,
it's like there's this hotel in Vietnam called the Caravelle.
Okay,
the Caravelle is just like the Westin Bonaventure.
Is it Saigon?
Yeah, Saigon. When I used to go back 25 years ago for the first time, a few times, that was like the Westin. It was like the tallest, most luxury hotel.
The outside elevator, like that whole thing.
Yeah.
And
then they have this rooftop where you can look
around. The rooftop, and it does a 360.
Well, Westin does that, right?
Yeah, the Westin does it, yeah.
But at the Caravelle, I think it was like 14 stories, and then you could, you know, look at the whole city. But now you go to Vietnam and downtown LA.
Mm-hmm.
These things are dwarfs now.
I know, they're dwarfs. Yeah, they got a dwarf. Yeah, I remember when you used to just come off the 101 into the 110, you could actually see the Staples Center.
Yeah.
See the Bonaventure. Now it's just, you can't
even see it.
You
can't even see the Bonaventure.
yeah.
But that's crazy how your mom had one job in LA, and that's...
Yeah. One job. Whenever I would bitch about work back in the day, or I was in production, and I was just complaining and all that shit, I would just think about, I'm like, this woman, barely speaking,
is crazy, yeah.
And, you know, was it educated here in the States? She held down one job for 30 plus years. Like, shut the fuck up, shit. Stop your bitch.
That's where that Mamba stuff starts
to kick in, right? That's where I really, really get my grounded, you know, work ethic, man. Oh, let me ask you, are you Buddhist or?
No, I was raised Catholic.
You're raised Catholic? Mm-hmm. That's also another thing that I didn't know. Now that I'm hanging out with a lot of our people.
Either or, right?
That there's a lot of Christian or Catholic, you know, Vietnamese. I know, you know, I have a really good friend, you know, Korean, and he's Catholic.
Yeah.
Christian. I knew that, but I didn't know us Vietnamese
were...
I didn't know. Yeah.
And I'm going to say this, Sean. The majority of the Vietnamese Americans that you will meet are probably the Catholics.
The Catholics.
Because they were... It's a long history.
Is it a long history that predates... Is it the French colonialism?
The French brought it in, yeah. And I'm just being... You know, I wouldn't say... I wouldn't say the majority are Catholics, but an overwhelming number are
Vietnamese Catholics. Yeah, see, that's something that I didn't know. And I'm meeting all these, you know, Vietnamese Catholics, like, you know, Andy Van. I was like, well, are you adopted, bro? What the fuck happened to you?
No,
you know what I'm saying? Yeah. I was like, no. We just like, no. And then, you know, learning the history about it. I was like, oh, shit.
A lot of us are. That's crazy.
These Mi Chongs did a bang up job, man, around the world.
I was just talking to these academics. They have their own podcast, and we were talking about that idea of where, for many years, I was like upset and antagonized over the French, colonizing our people. But then, like, as I'm going around the world and talking to Vietnamese people, it's a lot more complicated and nuanced than we think.
It is.
It's funny to say, fucking colonizers, white people. But there are certain things that they brought to the game that was like that we benefited too.
Absolutely.
Right?
I actually equate it to the Black experience in America, you know, where there's our oppressors who shoved this religion down our throat.
Yeah.
And used it as a tool of oppression.
Yep.
The same thing that happened in South America, right, with the indigenous folks. But what a lot of brown and black folks did, then what we did, and when I say brown, I also include Asian folks, is that then we turned around and took this thing that was shoved down our throat and then turned it around and used it here to not only galvanize, but then keep our people surviving through that very bleak, dark point of that experience, right? When we were oppressed and raped and harmed. And again, you know, like the Black experience in America, you know, that was our only refuge. Our only salvation was every Sunday at noon, right? This thing that kept us together for hundreds of years. The Black church was the community center. It was the community center for a lot of things, right? And allowed us to be hopeful and free and keep going. And so we used that same tool for the benefit.
Yeah.
And actually walked the walk, I would say, a lot more than our oppressors did. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
Like, actually used it for what it was meant.
Yeah, definitely.
Too. So like when you say the complexity of it,
yes,
that's it.
It's very complex. Not to make a quick left turn on you, but I do want to talk about this before you leave. The economics of becoming an artist, of becoming a comedian, a singer, whatever, is perplexing, right? Because at one end, you got like the people that make a shit ton of money.
Yeah, it could be very lucrative.
Yeah, it could be very lucrative.
Very small percentage.
And then at the other end, there's most of us who are not making anything, right?
Right.
But then, in your position, you are now getting paid and you're making a living. And I know you walked away from a lucrative side hustle.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I think about it, I'm like, do you believe that there are gatekeepers that are in the way of artists to make money? Or do you think it's really Mamba mentality through it all and you can make the money if you just keep grinding?
Very complex and nuanced question, because I can say, and you know, the last thing I ever want to come off as is like a hater, right? Or you know, I can't stand that shit. Like, I can't even stand that word. I try to surround myself by like-minded, ambitious, also kind people. But you can make the case that there are politics to the industry, and that there are gatekeepers that will use that privilege and power to manipulate and get what they want. And you can't make the case that a lot of these gatekeepers politic their way into being a gatekeeper because they couldn't get it off merits. And so deep down, they had to figure out this way to stay relevant. You can see, you can make a case. But then I also make the case that, as I always say, I say it all the time, you can't cheat the comedy gods. And eventually you'll get exposed. And eventually cream rises to the top. So if you have that drive and that passion, for the first five years of my comedy journey, that's an investment. And I knew it was going to be an investment. I wasn't getting anything out of it, other than the experience and then me having the ability to hone my craft as an artist. 5 years of investment.
Yeah.
It's all going in. There's nothing coming back. But because I was that passionate about it, you know, people got the equation backwards. You know, a lot of people think, you know, if I do this and this, then I'll get this. Then I'll get the bag. And like, no. If you're passionate, the money will come. That stuff will come. Whatever type of validation you're seeking and all that, as long as you're authentic and you're passionate about it, that will get there when you put your 10,000 hours in, right? People have it the other way, though. Those folks usually never make it. So at one point, you can say that there are gatekeepers and there are politics, just like every other industry, and there's some people who are here, maybe who shouldn't deserve to be there, but they are for whatever reason. You can't say that, but at the same time, on the other end, I believe that if you are passionate about it and you have that mama mentality and that drive and you're just a good person, you know, my whole mantra is, you know, I want to be the hardest worker in the room, be a nice person and be the hardest worker in the room. Be kind to everyone. I don't care if you're the valet guy or the fucking the owner of the economy store. I can give a shit. Just treat everyone the same and see everyone's humanity and just be a good person and work your ass off. If you're a good person and work your ass off, man, that goes so much further than anything on your fucking resume. I don't care.
That's like 95%.
I don't care what Ivy League school you came from. I don't care what your background is. That goes a lot further,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
You know? And so I tend to believe that and try to live in that lane, not cheat the comedy gods, not try to life hack it, not try to do any of that shit, because eventually you're going to get exposed. And if you're not ready, people will find out you're not ready for whatever that situation is.
Yeah.
So I try to live in that lane, man, and not really try to think about that shit, not really try to have that affect me.
Yeah.
You know? Well, Sean asked.
Thank you so much for...
Are we done already?
We're done.
I was going
to
ask.
We're done with the talking portion. Now we're going to transition over to the piano portion.
Oh, shit, man. I got nothing for these people, unfortunately. Have me back. I'll have some.
All right.
I appreciate that, though, man. But, dude, I'm just glad that we have voices in this game. When I say we, I'm talking about us Viets. That we have voices in this industry, and
but wait a minute. Why don't you have a podcast?
Oh, I used to pre-COVID. That's the next.
But why don't you resurrect it?
That's in talks. I want to.
Was it by yourself?
No, it was me and my creative partner, my good friend, and my buddy Jimmy. Who I said, who dared me to get in the comedy? My buddy Jimmy Fox, who dared me to get in the comedy. And then, you know, COVID happened, and then kids happened, and then we just couldn't with our schedules. He's, you know, very busy.
Wait, you had a kid with
busy dude.
Jimmy?
No, yeah. Two beautiful girls together.
Kids happened.
He has a family stuff, and, you know, things get busy and shit.
Yeah, but why don't you just do it yourself?
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, I want to.
Interview all these comics. And, you know, here's the thing with you. You're a good talker. You're funny. You're entertaining. And then I think, like, the guests with, especially all this comedian podcast, they all come up in their own set, and then they bring new people on. But it's all the same. Whoever their class is,
your circle, yeah, your class.
It's all your class, your peer group.
Group, yeah.
All of these guys, I'm like looking at all of them. Bobby Lee, again, you know, all these guys.
Yeah.
Even Rogan, you know, like it's arguably. I didn't know who the fuck Joey Diaz was in the beginning. I didn't know Bill Burr. I didn't know any of these guys.
Yeah.
Arguably, like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden, they got their own class of their cohort. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, I'm trying to create that for the Vietnamese, right? Like if you
and
did,
I fucking appreciate
Adam, that. I mean, Andy, if all of you guys had...
I appreciate that. I really do. And I'm glad that we have this outlet now. We actually are putting our fucking stake in this Hollywood game, but we need more.
We do.
That's what I'm saying. Guys like you.
Because I'm tired of these fucking Koreans. I keep telling everybody, these fucking Koreans, they doing too much, okay? Your shit's over. All right, you're not. You're coming. You have any Korean friends?
I do. Yeah,
this is a funny shit.
I do.
The amount of shit that you talk about Koreans.
Oh my god, I can't stand. Oh, I can't stand that they're killing this game. But no, man, I actually, you know, it's in talks. And part of the idea of the podcast I want to develop is not only having my peer group on to talk all things comedy, but I want to interview folks that might not be in my peer group, maybe younger comics, yep. older comics, not even comedians, other parts of the industry. Because yeah. Like we were talking about earlier, I'm so fascinated about, you know, not just comedy, but the other scopes of life. Absolutely. I'm just so interested, you know. I'm always, you know, I'm a firm believer of, like, you could never stop learning mm-hmm. and always have a thirst to learn.
And everything's interconnected.
You know what I mean? So I'd love to interview musicians and all that. Yeah, I mean, I'm actually in talks right now to develop. I have a really good friend of mine who is taking over a club in Hollywood, and you know, come this late October, and he's taking over the third wheel. And if we him and I were just talking about ideas for our podcast, and one of the ideas I had was comedians playing poker, talking shit.
That would be great.
And you know, just, you know, over a poker game, drinking some really good scotch. Having a cigar.
That'd be great.
And shooting.
I'm gonna end this on sure. this last question. How old were you when you first started to play poker?
Who taught you? I was, I would say, late 20s. Okay. You know? Kind of coincided with my comedy journey, to be honest with you. And like I tell everybody, you know, poker is a very expensive education.
I mean, but imagine if your mom and dad taught you when you were 5.
Right.
Do you think that would have helped your life?
I think that it's inherent in my DNA as a Vietnamese person that we're just inherent
fucking degenerate
to play fucking gambo and play poker. You know what I'm saying? It's like if you look at every World Series of Poker at the fucking final table, you always see a win, Tran, fucking, it doesn't matter. We're just inherently, but you know, I didn't grow up playing chess. That's my chess.
Yeah.
Boxing and poker are like my chess games.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you off air why I asked you this, but thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. We'll go get some lunch now, and that's awesome. Thank you.
Thanks, man. Cheers, everybody. Cheers.
Mokabayo.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin, too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.